Hello and welcome back to the IMD Podcast Network. This week we're bringing you a conversation between IMD's Jean-François Manzoni and Rohit Jawa, the former CEO and Managing Director of Hindustan Unilever.
I'm very fortunate today to speak with Rohit Jawa, CEO of Hindustan Unilever Limited, or HUL, as the company is often called. Rohit and I met a number of years ago when he led a remarkable and award-winning transformation of Unilever Philippines, and I'm delighted to meet him again today. Hindustan Unilever is owned 62% by Unilever and 38% by the Indian public and Indian institutions. It represents a very significant part of Unilever. For example, it's the number two country in beauty and well-being behind the USA. It is number three in personal care behind USA and Brazil, number one country in the world in home care, and number two in foods, again, behind the USA. Focusing on the Indian home market itself, HUL's impact and reach are even more impressive. 9 million outlets served, 3,500 distributors, 75 billion units produced in each year in 28 factories, and 9 out of 10 households in India consume at least one Hindustan Unilever product. Beyond the size, Hindustan Unilever has also been one of India's most distinguished, respected, and loved company, and that for decades. In particular, HUL is regularly voted the number one employer of choice and the most attractive company for women, all industries considered. HUL is also the top ESG-rated FMCG company in India, and I could name lots of other awards that the company has won. Shareholders, by the way, are very happy too, with a stock price that has essentially tripled over the last 10 years. Rohit became Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of HUL in 2023. He is also a member of Unilever's executive committee. He had started his career at Hindustan Unilever and then rose through the ranks, first within Hindustan Unilever and then within Unilever in roles of increasing breadth, including CEO of Unilever Philippines, then CEO of China and North Asia, then Chief Transformation Officer, before returning to Hindustan Unilever as the new CEO. Rohit, thank you for making the time to be with us today.
I'm very, very happy to be with you again, Jean-François. It's like old times back again.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Really looking forward to our conversation. Maybe let's start with giving people a sense for what Hindustan Unilever does. Now, it has four divisions. Can you give us a feel for what they do and also maybe a rough sense of how important they are within the big picture?
Well, you know, we've been in India for more than 90 years, so we're nearly a century old. We are sort of, we're deeply immersed in the Indian ecosystem and the culture. We've been serving most consumers there for a very, very long time. We operate through four big divisions.
Okay.
There's the home care division that's about under 40% of our sales. Things like laundry detergents, liquids, fabric conditioners and such. We've got the personal care division that has got brands like Lifebuoy, Lux. That's more in the space of personal wash and deodorants. We've got the beauty care division that does beauty and well-being products, skincare, hair and so on and so forth. And we now also have a very big foods division that is mainly tea, coffee, ketchup, and brands like that.
So home care, personal care, beauty and well-being, and foods.
Correct.
Now, the portfolio did not start out this way. Of course, when the company was founded, as you said, about 90 years ago, it has increased over time, including through acquisitions. But one of the things that has been constant is the fact that Hindustan Unilever has been an incredibly successful company for decades. You started your career there, you're now back as the CEO. What are some of the key components of this organization's success over decades?
Well, you know, since I've come back, that's a question I've asked first myself, because it's very important to capture the essence of what makes the company great. Because what makes the company great indeed is the fundamental core strengths on which any future can be built.
Okay.
And I've come distill them down to four big thoughts.
Okay.
The first one is really start with the consumer and the customer. When we're obsessed with the consumer and the customer, when we have strong insight, deep penetrative view, we tend to basically do great work and consumers reward us. The second, I believe, and the most important pillar is also have a market-making, innovation-led mindset. In our history, when we have, you know, been first to create new categories, we have found products and solutions that serve unmet needs or underserved consumers. That has done very well for us.
So a pioneering sort of mindset.
Pioneering mindset. Yeah. The third important consideration is that of value. India is extremely price-sensitive market in, at all levels, not just really at the levels of low income. So it's a very value-sensitive market. And ensuring that we design products to value is extremely critical. You know, optimize what consumer really cherishes and take the other things off and make a mix that really serves the consumer at the right price point. And the fourth very important aspect of our success is that we serve all consumers at all price points, and we have a wide and a resilient portfolio that covers basically every segment, every price point in the market. We serve all Indians.
And I want to come back on this last point, but please give me maybe one or two follow-up questions before we get to this. So certainly understood customer-consumer obsession, understood pioneering mindset, value mindset, and then this portfolio and this the breadth and the ability to segment, to touch all segments. Now, I wanted to ask you about the pros and cons of being a majority owned by Unilever. Tell me what's great about this and tell me some of the challenges.
Well, you know, we often say that what's good for India is good for HUL.
Okay.
That is a belief system that we've operated in the country for more than 90 years and coming up to a century. And increasingly, we're also saying what's good for HUL is good for Unilever.
Okay.
So we have a very symbiotic relationship. For Unilever, India is one of its key markets. We're number two in terms of size. Yeah. And clearly one of the most important markets for future value creation, notwithstanding how big we are at the moment. From an Indian point of view, from an HUL point of view, Unilever is a great source of R&D, of brands, and of best practices. And we, in turn, have also been a source of great talent. There are parts of emerging markets business model that we're very good at. Take, for instance, the traditional trade, even the digitization of traditional trade that we're very, very good at. And we've exported that capability to other markets of Unilever. And we've had a very large history of sending lots of good people across functions to Unilever. And, you know, you could look back at the track record of many of them. Reached senior most positions in Global Unilever as well. So on the whole, it's a symbiotic relationship. There's interdependency. And I believe that Unilever and HUL coexist basically with very aligned objectives.
So it sounds synergistic. One plus one is more than two.
Yes.
Now, R&D, of course, potential for great complementarity. I can also see how, you know, some of the brands that might be developed for part of the world X might not necessarily work for you. Also, you have a significant Hindustan Unilever R&D capability. So how do you find the right balance of what to borrow from them and what to develop yourselves? What to sometimes push back on?
To a large extent, it's a very very much driven by India for India mindset. Okay. We're such a large market for Unilever. And importantly, we do have two very big R&D centers, global R&D centers,
right,
based in India, in Mumbai and Bangalore, that have had many, many decades of history of building new products for India and for the world. A large part of the Indian R&D, therefore, for India R&D is done within these two centers.
Right.
So organically itself, given that two of the big global centers and large number of the scientists are based out of India, we essentially get what we need. But the superordinate objective is to essentially do what's right for India. And that does require adaptation, that requires localization, whether it be of taste and flavors, of cost.
And I guess you guys have been so successful that you must have very strong credibility within the system. If you tell them, no, this is not going to work, I guess nobody's going to argue with you guys.
Well, we've been in the country for so long, and we've had a history of solving for the Indian problems first with that mindset. So essentially, you know, we have many of our stable of 50 odd brands. Many of our brands are actually India for India brands only. For instance, a wheel powder that serves the mass end of the laundry market, or Kisan, that's a ketchup that's exclusively meant for India. So there's a large portfolio that's India for India. We design for India.
Right.
And there's a large portfolio that's global in nature, but is tuned and adapted for the Indian conditions. because it's quite big for India and it needs to have the right optimization. And then there are some brands, some parts of our portfolio that are more global in nature where we just lift and shift because, you know, it makes sense. So it's purpose fit rather than one size fits all.
Now, slightly iconoclastic question. Four divisions operating in different industries and also with very different competitors, many of whom are probably a little bit more focused. So if I think of P&G, it's going to be more personal care and home care. If I think of L'Oréal, obviously it's going to be more beauty and well-being. And if I think of Nestlé, for example, it's going to be more foods. So tell me about to what extent is it an advantage to have these four divisions? And or how do you compete with more focused, but also very successful and very good organizations?
Well, I think let's admit to the fact that the consumer goods world is extremely competitive. And from an India lens, it's getting more and more competitive. And the best of world, the kind of competitors you named, are in this game and they have very focused portfolios. So clearly, if as Unilever, as HUL, we're not as good or better. Each of these different playgrounds, we're not going to succeed. So we recognize the need for specialization, okay, which is the reason why we have these four very well-defined and clearly articulated divisions with very, very clear strategies and choices and capability sets. But at the same time, especially in markets like India, it's very important to recognize the leverage the scale gives you and the enterprise capabilities have in a country as large as India, where there's a lot of parts of the business model that could do much better with scale. For instance, serving our traditional trade.
Okay.
It would make a lot more sense to go together to a very small outlet in the deep rural areas than to go as four different companies.
I think I mentioned earlier, yeah, 9 million outlets served. So clearly some of these are relatively small.
Right.
And then indeed, so you can go together. Okay.
I mean, the same thing applies to knocking the doors of a very big modern trade partner, mm-hmm, where there's a lot that we can do together as a corporate, okay, as an enterprise. It makes no sense to have divisional resources in corporate resources like legal, like finance. So there's an immense amount of scale leverage.
Okay.
There's an immense amount of reputational leverage, the governance leverage that the HUL enterprise platform gives our four divisions. But at the same time, where required, you know, we want to be very, very focused, whether it's in the space of our marketing teams, our business commercial teams, or indeed even parts of our sales system that requires very specific bespoke routes to market. So we are building this very carefully nuanced sweet spot of scale and focus.
Yeah.
And I believe that there's no escaping that, especially in the market where you're already pretty big and you want to be, you know, much bigger, and where actually going as one HUL also makes a lot of sense. But in some cases, you also want to have the benefits of specialization and you know, competitive specialization and edge that comes by actually more focus. So we are essentially toggling this all the time to make sure that we are in tune with both the times and the needs of each division.
So there's a sort of ambidexterity. We need to be able to be very specialized in some parts of the activities, but also very collaborative and sharing in other parts.
Yeah, it's hard to do, but that's what will give us a competitive advantage, yeah, because it's not easy for other companies to copy that or mimic, right, that, because it does take tons of years of inexperience, of optimization,
right,
which is also true for many of our brands that have been just right sweet spot of global and local. Yeah. So I think that comes with a lot of practice and depth.
Purpose versus profits. Under Paul Polman's leadership, Unilever became known as a company that was very interested, of course, in its environmental and societal impact, and as one of the leaders of the profits with purpose kind of movement. HUL seems to have had a very clear and consistent position on this. Can you share it with us?
Purpose comes from deep from the roots and the history of the company Unilever. 90 years ago, when I said when HUL, or the mission or the belief that we have in the country as well in India, is what's good for India is good for HUL and Hindustan Unilever. So we found profits and purpose an integrative choice versus a choice of trade-offs.
Okay.
And I think what Paul did was to have brought that back into the focus,
okay,
into 2010 era, yeah, and beyond that. And what we've seen since then basically is an era of calling out this multi-stakeholder model as the right model, followed by very specific metrics and plans and commitments, followed by now when it's not just about having a mission or a purpose, it's also not just about having lots of plans and commitments, it's about having them delivered, okay, and making an impact. And what we've done recently in the growth action plan is to have really focused on four pillars: climate, nature, plastic, and livelihoods. And within that, a very set of focused targets with very clear set of plans where we are now wanting to go deep in areas that we as Unilever and HUL can have the highest impact.
Okay.
And those are performance managed, like we would manage any part of the business, because we believe it's not just about making a commitment, but about having them delivered in a very defined time frame.
Okay.
And that's really, you know, inch wide and mile deep. That's really the emphasis shift that you've seen off late. It's just getting more focused and more performance orientated in fewer areas that we can make the highest impact.
So instead of let's focus, you know, as a general statement, purpose and profits, let's be much more specific and let's select areas where we can have a very big societal and or environmental impact.
Yes.
And of course, let's also try to connect this to some form of financial performance.
Yeah, and you know, at a meta level, you know, especially in India, where we are serving all Indians, our license to exist, to prosper, is driven by a symbiotic relationship with the community. So we have to be a responsible citizen. We are there because we have an Indian soul, although, you know, we are foreign-owned multinational. And we're seen as an Indian company because we've been there, we've been good for India, and India's been good for HUL. So I think we in HUL see it more as a reason to exist.
Yeah.
And it's very deeply immersed in the culture and the value system of Hindustan Unilever.
And then, of course, building on these decades of success, you've now been CEO, including the period where you were CEO designate for about 2 years. And so you've started to put your own imprint on HUL strategy and direction. In particular, you launched a strategic plan called Aspire, Unlocking a Billion Aspirations, which features three pillars: focus, excel, and accelerate. And the financial ambition is bold. It's to achieve double-digit EPS growth driven by top line. So it is very much a growth-oriented plan. And of course, these plans for an organization as large as HUL features a lot of initiatives, some of which I read and most of which we won't be able to get into. But maybe can you highlight for us the few kind of signature moves, the few key parts of this Aspire Unlocking a Billion Aspirations plan?
Well, just to headline and give a very simple definition of each of these pillars, and I will zoom into focus pillar for our discussion. So focus really is about focusing on the portfolio of the future. Excel is about excelling in five very specific demand drivers that impact the future. And accelerate is deepening our moats, like supply chain, like technology, like distribution, and digitization.
And when you say our moats, that means the things that are protecting our business and our profitability.
Yes. I mean, for instance, you talked about 9 or 10 million households, 9 million retail outlets. We have, you know, in excess of 70% value-added distribution directly. That is a moat that would be very difficult for our competitors to copy, to build. Our supply chain reach, we have 28 factories. We are, you know, we can make large, we can make small. We operate at a very, very lean cost, very agile. That would be very difficult for others to build. So these are moats. Now, zooming in on focus, because that's really the major pivot of the next, I would say, decade, is that India as a country, as a consumer market, is changing quite fast. I mean, it's not a surprising headline to start with. But if you just look under the surface, one, India is getting richer. So the affluent plus, so we call them Alpha and India One, the pyramid is becoming more of a flatter pyramid and then into a diamond. So consumers are upgrading, and that means they are getting into new habits, new categories are being built. Second, it's a very digitized economy now.
Okay.
Each and every consumer has an access to, you know, same information, same entertainment. They know what good quality of life looks like. That opens up, you know, their dreams, also their aspirations, although it is still very, very value conscious. And it's also, thirdly, a very young country.
Okay.
Because to the median age of 28, maybe 32, by 2030 still means that a lot of consumers have to get into the working age population. They'll buy new homes, they'll have new kitchens, new bathrooms, new habits. So that is many, many more years of great category creation opportunity, and the consuming class is basically coming into scale, and it's going to be the best consumer story in the world in the next decade or so. So clearly, that's a very important moment for HUL. We are already very big, but for us to basically get even bigger and more successful, what got us here is not going to get us there.
Okay.
So the most important part of that basically is our portfolio. And we have now divided our portfolio basically in three broad parts. There is what we'd call core, which is our legacy portfolio that serves most of our consumers in rural areas or in low-income category. And then you have what we call future core. These are mainly our 10 big brands that are premium, that are aspirational. There's high levels of growth, more margins. And then we'd call market makers a smaller part that is really absolutely new segments that are being created that are going very fast, very small, but very early years in their evolution. So what we want to do essentially is to move our portfolio from our core to future core and to our market makers. And that shift requires very mindful resource allocation, requires very mindful portfolio evolution, requires very mindful business model evolution and transformation, and the channels and media choices that we use to serve them. That, I believe, is the biggest part of this Aspire strategy. It requires us to premiumize aggressively as the country sort of evolves. Just focusing on what is big today
is not
good enough. In fact, focusing on what's big today, focusing on what's going to be big tomorrow, and what's going to be big day after tomorrow, all at the same time, if we want to be as big as we are in India and want to be even bigger, we've got to do all of the three engines at the same time. I think this is the new skill set of essentially doing these engine one, engine two, and engine three all at the same time.
And in our vocabulary at IMD, we often talk about perform and transform, which is another way of
you
saying
got it. Now, perform and transform. Actually, it's a word Fernando, new CEO, uses a lot as well.
Okay. So digital and more generally technology, you've mentioned it already, transforming the organization in so many ways. So first of all, there's really a very fast shift in terms of the way you approach marketing activities. And I'm curious about how, to what extent this created a skills gap or some resistance within the organization.
I think this is a key challenge because our channel model of serving channels and our media and marketing models are changing quite dramatically. And as I mentioned to you, that consumers in India are universally digitized. There's a billion internet connections on mobile phones. E-commerce goes to almost 250 million consumers and increasing. So very fast, the channels are shifting from traditional trade to modern trade and to e-commerce, and within that, various different pods and platforms. At the same time, the way consumers use media is also changing.
Right.
Of roughly 6 hours a day, half the time is now on digital, and a lot of that time is on social. So therefore, you know, good old days of making a lovely 30-second spot and, you know, an epic, iconic story are not fully gone, but they're largely gone. You have to have multiple asset types to serve consumers in social media environments. You've got to have things that are culture-first thinking, things that create talkability, and so on and so forth. Influencers, for instance.
Right.
And it's a lot of that is now fairly digitized. And therefore, it does require a very different set of muscles. And we've had to make sure we learn all of them. We create codified processes, ways of working. Because the change is very fast. It's not like, you know, in slow motion, like let's say modern trade came. It took many years. We've got to do all of this pretty fast as well. And sometimes there are no real answers. Because, you know, the way e-commerce is being built in India is quite different from the way it was built in China, it was built in the US. Some similarities, but a lot different. So there's a lot of bespoke learning by doing and trying to, at the end of the day, build things around fundamental principles. For instance, e-commerce is about traffic, it's about conversion, it's about basket size and lifetime value. So some fundamental drivers of growth don't change, but the tools are very, very different and we've got to be open-minded. And we invest in training. We invest in getting people with native skills.
Okay. So you have to hire people with those kinds of skills.
You do. And importantly, it's also not enough to do that because if you take supply chain, where we work with the blue-collar workers of all kinds of skill sets.
Okay.
And supply chain is also getting fairly digitized. It's got to be done at scale, which means the shop floor worker should understand how to use technology. And now we have many dark cascades where we don't use a lot of human beings, but it's done through machines, through control systems, and we've got to train our shop floor workers to operate them.
Okay.
And they do learn. So I think investing in digitization or skill is not just about getting specialists. It's really about trying to also do this at scale to essentially make a large number of our employees digitally fluent and at least learn how to apply it.
This is also in a way a process of segmentation, right? Because you're not going to teach the workers the same thing that you're going to teach those guys. So you have a very deliberate digital upskilling program.
Yes, we do. And we measure it, for instance, supply chain, as I'm mentioning, because we've got 28 factories and we've got so many workers. We have a digital transmission index that has got various things, metrics and impact. So it's not doesn't become a pilot purgatory, but actually something that really generates business benefit. And essentially, you want to either, you know, sell more or save more or do work easy. Eventually, digitization is just a tool.
Right.
It must generate the benefits of, you know, growth, cost, or ease of working.
Direct to consumer. You have 10 direct to consumer websites. Today, Nike registers about 40% of their sales direct to consumer, which of course is a dramatic change to 10 years ago. How large do you expect direct to consumer to become for you guys?
So direct to consumer for us is still a very small part of our total sales throughput. But I think if I was to reframe your question as to what part of our sales are going online, because we sell a lot more through platforms of different kinds than through our own websites, given the nature of our business. For some of our brands like Lakme, it's a very large percentage. But in most of our businesses, it's not that large.
Okay.
But if you reframe the question as to what's the level of online sales, that for a country that's got $2,500 per capita, we're already at about 7-8% and growing very, very fast. And the level of innovation in particularly online commerce is quite breathtaking in India.
Now, the plan involves heavy investment in brands and a lot of cost efficiency elsewhere. Now here, you know, slight confession, during my 8 years at the helm of IND, I didn't find this combination super easy. On one side, there are parts of the organization where, you know, we are investing quite heavily, including in customer service and so on. And at the same time, we're asking the rest of the organization to be quite frugal. So there's really two speeds. How is this working within HUL?
The value ethic of the Indian culture,
right,
and consumer seeps in also into HUL's middle class value system.
Okay.
Where we believe that frugality and efficiency is a matter of great pride. Okay. And we look at productivity as an always-on program, not as a one-off program. We look at productivity as a source of fuel for growth. And we've had a program we call Symphony for many years now. It's end-to-end. So we start from all parts of our cost system, from pricing, because you can get more of that, through, you know, net revenue management, cost, both direct and indirect costs, our brand marketing investments, our overheads. And we basically, every year, keep looking for opportunities to find savings. In fact, we have gone on public that we are looking to 3-4% of our turnover as savings every year. A lot of them help to make sure that our brands remain affordable, right price points for our consumers, and we also need more and more investments for the sort of things you mentioned behind our brand. So it's a virtuous flywheel that we've learned to use again and again. And every year we start with, you know, okay, here's the growth plan and here's the savings plan. And it's basically that yin and yang, and it works quite together for us. And we run it as a whole activity system where the entire company basically joins in, because it's a very cross-functional end-to-end program.
And you're not concerned that the emphasis on the cost reduction somehow will lead people to do things that might be good in the short run, but will end up undermining the growth efforts? That never happens?
That risk does exist. That sometimes in the, you know, aggression of, say, product savings, you might end up getting things, you know, cut down to a point where consumers start to notice. So we always have these tight measures on, if you're looking at a product optimization, we have alienation tests to make sure that consumers don't see that as an inferior product. Okay. Or we're looking for alternative substitute materials that can do the same job at a low cost or easier access. And importantly, this is a source of creativity and innovation, because we're looking at structural breakthroughs on how we do work, how we formulate things. Why does it have to be done the old way? Why not the new way? And there's always, you know, new ideas, and as time goes by, new solutions emerge, technologies change. And this is a process of constant renewal. And in fact, we now have added another element in our Symphony program. We call it the Symphony Lab, where we look at financial savings that are very deeply structural in nature that will not impact in-year delivery, but if done well, they will impact future years' value streams. So I feel it's a very, very important innovation program that creates the fuel for the growth, keeps the company lean, and basically it's a matter of great pride for people to sort of find the value in how we do business and keeps us contemporary. And it's not a cost reduction plan, but a productivity plan.
Okay.
It's a fuel for growth plan. Okay. We don't see it as reducing a cost base. Okay. It's about is getting better bang for the buck. So that's a big.
It's interesting. So yeah. The framing and the vocabulary also, this is not cost reduction, this is productivity and fuel for growth.
Absolutely.
Hindustan Unilever is also known as the preferred employer in India, basically across categories, including, by the way, also the preferred employer for women, and in part because it develops talent. Tell me about your perspective on the importance of talent and on what you guys are doing to, year after year after year, be the preferred employer in a very competitive market.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that when I joined HUL back in 1988, it was the number one employer, the best marketing company, and 37 years down the line, which is nearly four decades, it still is. That says a lot for the consistency and the robustness of our processes in human capital. But it basically, if you systematize that, it starts from recruitment.
Okay.
We have a strong employer brand investment. We are the most preferred employer brand in the top business schools in India. We've remained that for a long, long time. We measure that. We invest in it. We make sure that we have tools and techniques and programs that keep us very fresh and very exciting for all commercially good talent in these top institutes. Our training program or development program in what we call Unilever Future Leaders Program. In my days, it was called the Management Training Program. Is still very much built on the same principles, a lot of market experience. You start in sales, you cross over to marketing, you do all functions, you work as a salesman and you work as a brand manager, you do the entire gamut of business, creates cross-functional, general managerial, ambidextrous managers. We have lifelong learning culture, so our people love to go through training programs. Leaders train, so leaders teach.
Okay.
We have 4 Acres, our global learning center. We have 99 East, which is our HUL's learning center in the campus. When I joined, it was a place called Kulita. So the same institution exists where there's programs on competencies, programs on leadership development. We do send people to great institutions like yours as well as people grow. We have mid-career programs to make sure we just look at also talent from outside. And a large section of our employee base comes from mid-career. And at the end, our attrition levels are much lower than the industry. So we continue to also remain a place where people do spend long careers, very different from the rest of the world right now. And that gives us loyalty, it gives us experience, collective organizational knowledge, and it creates basically consistency. So we found this entire process of, ecosystem of the cycle of human capital. We've optimized it over years, and that continues to be an important source of value creation for us in HUL and indeed in Unilever.
Most organizations have some of the things that you've described, but somehow it works a heck of a lot better with you guys. Is that the secret? Or do you have more some practices that are different from the others?
I think it's the consistency. Take our management training program or the Unilever Futures Leaders program. That has been going on, in fact, even before my time, for many, many decades.
Okay.
That creates a cadre of very high qualified, culturally assimilated group that grows in the company and carries the sort of this fabric, the gene, the DNA forward. That would be one contributory factor. And I do think that there is a very high recognition for the role of human capital as a source of value creation and the pride you have of working with HUL or being one of the HUL's quality products, so to speak.
Okay.
And people who leave Unilever or retire also, they say you cannot take a lever out of a man, you can take man out of Unilever, or you can't take a lever out of woman, you can take woman out of Unilever.
So you have alumni, proud alumni.
Very proud alumni. So it is, I think, people make the best friends within the company.
Okay.
So it's a lot to do with our culture. So the social organization.
The virtuous spiral.
Yes. So I think it's beyond just the tools.
Right.
It's to do with consistency, discipline, the value of human capital, and importantly, it's about the social organization and the tissue that HUL has built over many, many decades.
Now, as you know, Rohit, I'm a leadership professor, so I have to ask you a few more personal questions. And let me start with an assumption. You and I started at HUL a few decades ago, and you know, over the first few years, we went through the ranks together. Would I have known then that 3 decades later you would be the CEO of the company or the CEO of a large Indian company?
I don't think so. I think at that stage, people would have known me as somebody who was values-based, somebody who had worked very hard, somebody who was driven by learning and growth and personal development, okay, and somebody who would do well in life or in work or, you know, grow. But it would be presumptuous to say at that stage that, you know, early years of my training or career in HUL, even I was looking at that as sort of the ultimate lighthouse.
Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
So, because recently I asked the CEO and he said, well, they wouldn't have known, but I knew. So was this one of your ambitions or not really?
I was always looking at, okay, what can I be? What is my potential? How much can I grow? And it's been more episodic where I've looked at the next 5 or 10 years and can I stretch to the next level and then to the next level? And, you know, fast forward to the future, I'm here. I did not start by saying, okay, I want to be...
So it wasn't, yeah, I want to get there. How do I get there? It was more like 5, 10 years at a time.
5, 10 years at a time. I do think as I, you know, when I came into the business world, I came in with love for marketing.
Okay.
As I came into the business world and HUL, I love to be in teams and I love to lead teams. I knew, okay, I enjoyed it. I got the thrill of business because I love the P&L management and the joy you get from achieving something good. Often then it's, you know, from a turnaround situation and you made some really big changes, and, you know, you can write a story on it. Then increasingly I found I was good at multicultures, that I was able to adapt and be agile. And then later on I found that I could not just be a good GM, but I could now, you know, run a fully listed, publicly facing company as well. And every time, I must say, it's been a stretch. It's been new learning. And then I have surprised myself. And so it's never been, you know, this grand vision of, okay, I'm going to be. Okay. But it's just been, okay, let me stretch to the next level. And can I do more? And can I achieve my potential? Can I max it? So that's really been how I've driven myself so long. It's not over as yet.
Let me build on this hypothetical. So we started together.
Yeah.
And then you left and you made your way in the world of Unilever outside India. And then recently you came back. And so I remember you from 30 some years ago. And obviously now I'm in contact with you in this life. What's the same? What's different?
There is a lot that is different, but there's also a lot that is same. We start with that first. So I would say, having, you know, thought of this question, been more self-aware in later years, clearly my value systems of integrity, of hard work, of just being a good person, or being decent, that hasn't changed. What has changed, of course, is basically my agility and adaptability, having been through so many different countries, lived and worked. I have, of course, got, I would say, physically more balanced than I was many, many years ago. I've learned to, you know, have a daily routine on exercise. I've learned to be mindful of what I eat. I've learned to also be emotionally more calm, to think, see things, reframe them and see things in a more philosophical way, okay, often with experience and learning. I've learned
to take more perspective.
Take more perspective.
Okay.
And I've clearly learned to also realize what does work in business over years and what we must not take for granted, but equally what does not always work, and to start every chapter with a fresh pair of eyes, to start things, ask the what, why, who questions, and start again, and not force with sort of old solutions to new problems. And I've learned to come to a point that, you know, there's always opportunities to learn. I mean, what's happening with technology around us is transformative, it's breathtaking. We don't know how massive the world will change. So if at all now, there's absolutely no time to stop. We have to keep learning. So I think there's that growth mindset clearly has got deepened and even sharpened over the last 2 decades. And I do think having lived in so many countries and cultures and business situations has made me way more adaptable than I was before I left.
A word that has come back often in the last few minutes is, I learned this, I learned that. Are you a conscious, deliberate learner? Do you make notes or do things come to you relatively effortlessly?
No, I like learning. I like going back to, so I have various models that I use now. Every few years, I would go back and, you know, go back to an institution. I did that with IMD, I did that with Harvard, or take a course. But equally, I also do pause every few weeks and I reflect at different points in my year, in my career, and I write things down. Okay. I distill them down and try to find, okay, what went well, what didn't go well, why. I read.
There is a deliberate reflection.
There is. I read. I read the same thing sometimes over and over again to see them from another perspective, or read about the same things over and over again to see if, you know, I'm missing perspective, and try and keep distilling things down to what I, in every stage of my career growth, I need, okay, here's a new set of muscles I need to build. Until now, this has worked well for me so far, but not beyond that. So, okay, what do I do deliberately to become that person now? And so it's a very deliberate, conscious effort to improve.
Now, that takes time. And of course, you also have a full-time job and you also have a family. How have you managed to balance all of this? You've said already, I've become more disciplined on the exercise side and the nutrition side. I imagine also on the sleep side. We often talk about eat, move, sleep. Beyond that, how have you been able to make time for all of this, and still remain sane?
Look, this role, and I'm sure all other CEOs and other general management roles that I've done in the past, these are full-on roles. Yeah. You take them consciously. You know that you are committed. You have to serve your employees, your brand, your stakeholders, and that is the number one priority. So clearly, that does mean that it impinges on, you know, you're 24/7 in that sense. But there are moments. I mean, I have a routine to, you know, take the morning. Mm-hmm. I normally get to the gym in the morning in most days of the week. There are times I take a break. I mean, Saturdays for me sometimes is a, you know, decompression day.
Okay.
I love music. I love being with the family. I love meeting my children there in other parts of the world. And I love watching, dramas and TV. And I enjoy that moment as well. I love being with my wife as well. So all of this is a way of keeping sane and remaining anchored.
But it means that you must have relatively clear boundaries also for work.
I would be remiss to say that I have that very, very sharp. It's a hard thing to do to, you know, stop that work-life transition is not that crystal or not that easy. So often it's, you know, like I said, I said this Saturday, it's a decompression day.
Okay.
May not be all Saturdays, but okay, this Saturday it is.
Okay.
And
so there's a flexibility in the system.
Yeah.
Do you say no often?
Saying no, actually, in my view, is a very important skill set, and I'm learning to do more of that.
Okay.
Because take, for instance, the role I'm in, and I'm probably getting an invite a day for something.
Right.
And if I did everything, I'd probably do nothing. And I'm very mindful that the way I allocate my time should be no more than a third, let's say, in things that are outside the company, whether it be consumers, customers, of course, that must take precedence, but also I should not fill that all up with meetings and discussions and all of that are outside. So I try and be very mindful of focusing on my team, on my markets, on my consumers and customers first, and keep, you know, the external interaction to what is absolutely essential. Otherwise, you could just go upside down. So it's very important to say no in certainly how your time is used. Because, you know, there's demands aplenty in a role like this.
But including internally, right? I'm sure that people must be inviting you to meetings. You could be in meetings like 24 hours a day. So there's some meetings where you're going to show up and some meetings where you're going to go, no, I'm not showing up. How do you decide that?
Very important is to have a set of team that I can fully trust and delegate to.
Okay.
I'm at my best when I can empower and delegate. At one level, I can jump in and scrutinize, and that is my, I would say, a muscle that I should not overuse, and I tend to sometimes. So it's very important. I'm at my best when I'm able to delegate, have people who I can trust. So the best way of actually not being in situations where being dragged into everything is to have a set of people who are really good, they know what they're doing, and you know when they're in charge, things are going to get better.
Okay.
So that for me is the most important way. Otherwise, yes, you'll get dragged into parts of the business and, you know, eventually make you less effective, not leaving enough time to reflect, to see the future and shape the agenda of the company.
Last question. Rohit, you love your job because?
Because every time I'm here, I have an opportunity to make this a better place than I found, to create impact that lasts way longer than my time. And perhaps also with a stage as big as Unilever and Hindustan Unilever, I can impact a lot, a much, much bigger community than in any other situation. So it's really these three things of constant strive for excellence and improvement and transformation. It's about really making an impact that's long lasting and impacting a wider community.
Roy, thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Jean-François. It's always a pleasure to speak to you and always to reconnect back with you.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.